Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll hear about how abandoned mines still threaten the environment and water supply, but funding for abandoned mine cleanup may be able to help.
We have people that live in close proximity to the dump. One house, I believe, is within 100 feet. People have had to suffer with this for many years, so we're glad to see something happening with it.
We'll learn more about how the people who own much of the land in coal country don't actually live in Appalachia.
Most of the land in central Appalachia and was not historically and still is not owned by people who actually live there. Those people don't have any stake in the communities there. They don't have any reason to reinvest in developing the human capital and, you know, public services and goods.
And what can Appalachia learn from post-coal economies out west? We'll talk with a reporter in Colorado about how former coal communities are trying to rebuild their local economies.
They can live relatively cheaply compared to our urban areas. There are trails or restaurants or whatever that are attractive to young people. And in a few towns in the West, that has actually turned into especially young families coming and staying.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Since the turn of the 20th century, the coal industry has provided good-paying jobs for families across Appalachia. Coal companies constructed towns for their workers to live, and they attracted immigrants from across the globe to this region. But coal and other extractive industries have hurt us too. The boom and bust cycle means that when these industries decline, companies abandon communities, oftentimes leaving behind expensive challenges like crumbling infrastructure, people with poor health, and environmental waste. Today we're looking at some of the long-term effects of our deep ties to the coal industry and how communities out west are struggling with some of these same issues. We'll hear how much we have in common with former coal communities in Colorado and Montana, and we'll ask, what can we learn from each other? We'll begin in Pennsylvania, one of the states that's still dealing with damage from the mines dug more than 40 years ago. Residents of this Appalachian town are eager to repair their landscape, but this takes both time and money. President Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke oversees the federal agency in charge of cleaning up thousands of abandoned mines. He recently made a quick visit to one Pennsylvania town to announce funding that will soon be available to help communities clean up old mines. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Black Dog Hollow is a 100-foot-tall pile of coal and rock, an ugly hill created by the unwanted cuttings from a mine that closed 30 years ago. Nothing grows on it. It's eroding into nearby streams, and acid runoff pours off of it every time it rains. At a crowded fire hall just down a hill from the pile, Marianne Kabaki said it's generally a nuisance.
We have ATVs riding there, a lot of trespassing. Of course, it's unsecured. Many entrances and exits to the dump. So we've had a lot of complaints about that, and we have had people get hurt there.
Kabaki is the secretary of East Bethlehem Township in Washington County. She was awaiting the arrival of Ryan Zinke, Secretary of the Interior. Zinke had chosen her town as the place to announce this year's abandoned mine funding because East Bethlehem is a poster child for why the program exists. Created in 1977, the Abandoned Minelands Fund helps states deal with the legacy of historic coal mining. With funding from the program, Black Dog Hollow is slated to get cleaned up in the next few years, which will come as a relief to Kabaki and the rest of the community.
We have, of course, the eroding channels, the water that fills our storm drains eventually ends up in our river. We have people that live in close proximity to the dump. One house, I believe, is within 100 feet, the closest one. People have had to suffer with this for many years, so we're glad to see something happening with it.
After arriving at the fire hall, Zinke came to the microphone. A tall Montanan and former Navy SEAL, Zinke said Pennsylvania was still ripe for coal mining.
And here, there's economic opportunity, and we can do it right. But we also have to learn from the past.
That was a past before modern regulations prevented companies from leaving scars on the land like Black Dog Hollow. With federal abandoned mine funding, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection will grade the site and treat the acidic topsoil so that plants will grow on it.
I think in probably between 12 months and 18 months, we're going to see grass in the hill. And in 5 years, we'll see trees. And compared to what it is today, to what it will be, that's in a positive direction.
Zinke revealed the amount for this year's cleanup program, $300 million, and he even signed one of those symbolic oversized checks.
It's only as good as the government.
Of that $300 million, Pennsylvania's share will be $55 million, second only to Wyoming. It's an increase over what the state has gotten over the past few years, thanks to a change in funding set out by Congress in 2006, when it reauthorized the program. The state's share is so big because it has so many old mine sites, 800, the most in the country. John Stefanko of the Pennsylvania DEP said that all told, the state's abandoned mines would cost $15 billion to clean up. At current funding levels, that work will go on for decades.
It's really hard to how to predict, but it definitely will not be in my lifetime and probably not your lifetime either.
The DEP has yet to determine when it will begin construction on Black Dog Hollow. Reed Frazier, State Impact Pennsylvania.
The fund to clean up abandoned mines was part of the Federal Surface Mine and Reclamation Act of 1977. The money in the fund comes in part from taxes levied on coal companies. Before the act, coal companies were not required to take responsibility for the damage left in the wake of mining. Nowadays, mining companies are supposed to meet water quality and environmental standards or pay for the damage. Now, as another energy industry grows, activists are hoping we learn from those expensive mistakes. Coal isn't the only industry that can leave behind an expensive mess to clean up. As the natural gas industry continues to expand, there are concerns about radioactive waste, one of the byproducts of fracking. Fracking uses pressurized water, sand, and chemicals to extract gas from bedrocks deep underground. As Mary Meehan reports, this type of waste is still not adequately tracked or regulated, and illegal dumping is a real concern.
2015. The state, the energy and environment.
That's Tom Bonney with the Concerned Citizens of Estill County, beginning a press conference with a recap of how fracking waste came to rest in Irvin. In the 2 years since, the community has come to a consensus on what should happen with the illegally dumped waste. Dig it up and move it out. As Estill resident Nancy Farmer put it,
removal of the contaminated waste is the best answer to this problem.
The State Environmental Protection Cabinet has other ideas and is considering a much cheaper proposal to manage the waste in place. But this disagreement is a small part of a big problem with tracking the disposal of fracking waste. Nadia Steinzor researches the issue for the nonprofit Earthworks.
Waste is kind of the forgotten stepchild of the oil and gas shale boom. It's something that people really need to pay more attention to and be more concerned about.
As the Ohio Valley Resource and Center for Public Integrity reported in 2016, the patchwork of state laws makes it hard to track waste as it is generated, processed, shipped, and dumped. Steinzor says there is more awareness of the problem because more communities are being affected. But she says little has changed.
But from a regulatory perspective, policies and mandates and requirements the industry has to adhere to are still lagging behind.
Steinzor says it's crucial for people living near landfills to be aware of what's being dumped there, but that's not easy.
There's one gentleman in West Virginia who's been tracking waste coming into landfills there, and he literally, you know, would stand at the entrance to the landfills and see all these trucks coming in, and he'd ask the drivers where they're coming from, and lo and behold, they're coming from oil and gas sites.
Rhonda Childers in Estill County has been concerned about contamination at the landfill for 20 years. She was part of a group of activists who worked to get the rules in place to keep out radioactive material. But as the landfill changed owners, those rules were violated.
And we let our guards down, and we just kind of ignored this.
The state has fined the landfill owners and is requiring a mitigation plan. But Childers says all communities should be vigilant about what is happening at local landfills.
We're talking about Estill County today. We could be talking about Powell County tomorrow. We could be talking about any county in Kentucky.
Or any county with a landfill. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan in Irvin, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. As construction continues on controversial natural gas transmission pipelines, thousands of miles of smaller pipelines are being built in Appalachia. In Pennsylvania and Ohio, pipelines connect drilling well pads to the energy distribution system. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports these smaller pipelines could be having big impacts on streams and wildlife that live there.
High school students file into Nicole Costello's small reptiles class at the Penta Career Center in Toledo, Ohio.
All right, welcome, welcome to this.
They're learning firsthand how to foster an aquatic species that experts say is in decline, the eastern hellbender salamander. In a biosecured room on campus, 18-year-old Teresa Paff and other students clean the glass tanks, weigh and cut up worms to feed the young hellbenders they're raising. Paff picks up one that's 3 years old.
This is really hard to hold. They always like to move, and they're so slimy and slippery.
These are not the cute, colorful little salamanders that might come to mind. They're brown and mottled.
Some people would say so ugly they're cute.
Greg Lips is an expert on hellbenders at Ohio State University and works with the high school program. He says there's good reason they're often called snot otters, Allegheny alligators, and old lasagna sides.
They're kind of a flattened, wrinkly-sided, beady-eyed salamander. Everything about them is made to live underneath a big rock in tight spots and darkness.
Lip says the adults can get big, over 2 feet long, and can live 35 years or more. They're mainly found in streams along the Appalachian Mountains in Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio. And these guys are tough. The species has survived for 1 million years, which is why Lips was so concerned when he and a colleague found an 82% drop in their populations in Ohio. They just weren't finding many young hellbenders.
It's kind of like if the whole world became a nursing home overnight. You know that the end is near if you don't have any youngsters in these populations.
Researchers suspect the problem has to do with increased sediment in the water. Young hellbenders are thought to live in little spaces in gravel beds that are easily filled with sediment. Lips has watched as waterways, especially in the steep hills of eastern Ohio near the Pennsylvania and West Virginia borders, have gotten muddier. The reason seems obvious to him. Pipelines.
And you can trace this. It's not rocket science when you see the muddy water to drive upstream until you see clear water and then figure out, well, what's happening? Where's the in-between? And when I've done that, it's been pipeline construction.
Back taxiing runway 24, Marshall County.
To get a better picture of the gas pipeline boom here, Ted Alk of Frack Tracker, a nonprofit that tracks the fracking industry, has organized a tour by plane of West Virginia and Ohio. As we get into the air, he's floored by how many hillsides are cleared of trees to make way for pipelines.
Look at this one, Julie. Look at how zig and zagging this puppy is.
You can see these gathering lines connecting every well pad and compressor station. Ohio and Pennsylvania are among the states with the most gathering lines in the country, each with more than 20,000 miles of them. Pipeline companies are supposed to replant the pipeline corridors, but Alk says many don't.
That's all pipeline, see? And they have not hydroseeded that. You see what I'm talking about? And they've got that apron, that tarping material that's just supposed to prevent the loading of sediment down, but they didn't hydroseed any of that.
On the ground in eastern Ohio, the hills are alive with pipeline construction. To the north are the bigger transmission lines, the Mariner East and the Rover. Smaller gathering lines have names like the Hot Sauce Hustle and Dr. Awkward. Ohio State researcher Greg Lipp says when companies strip these steep hillsides of forest for pipelines, it can destroy his team's efforts to restore stream banks and protect the habitat for eastern hellbenders and other aquatic species.
What you create is effectively what can be a river of mud every time it rains. Now, it's really a problem, and the amount of silt and sediment that can come from a pipeline cut and from an eroding stream bank is immense.
Many of the new pipelines also cross the streams themselves, like here in Captina Creek, a high-quality stream and home to hellbenders. It empties into the Ohio River. The pipeline companies either bore underneath the stream bed or dig right through the water. According to an Allegheny Front review of applications to the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, the state has issued at least 13 permits, including 66 pipeline stream crossings in the Captina Creek watershed alone since 2014. Harry Kalapolitis manages the Ohio EPA's permitting process. His agency, as required by the Clean Water Act, certifies that pipeline crossings are not going to jeopardize stream quality.
We evaluate what benefits to society it may have and weigh that against the potential impacts to water quality. Our lower bar is not jeopardizing the existing use or how that stream is performing. And we do authorize the potential lowering of water quality with potential mitigation to make up for that loss.
Kalapolitis says there's no regulation looking at the cumulative impacts of the new lines. But he says they have not seen impacts on any streams from multiple pipeline crossings.
We evaluate a lot of streams in Ohio. And, you know, to my knowledge, we haven't had any of those reports come back to us and say that the stream is jeopardized by multiple crossings associated with pipeline projects.
Still, Kalapolitis says the Ohio EPA will propose new sediment regulations for pipelines in the coming months. And researchers at West Virginia University are starting to look at ways to reduce the environmental impacts of pipelines. Michael Strager is a professor of resource economics. In a study that just got funded, he plans to use GIS technology and drones to map pipelines in the region. And then his colleague will match the locations with water quality data in nearby streams.
So I think how our work is going to be useful is to really aid in the permitting process as part of a planning approach to really direct this industry to places where it can potentially have less of an impact than others.
Like students at the Penta Career Center, these West Virginia researchers want the waterways clean enough so species like the eastern hellbenders can survive here. The high schoolers will join experts and release the young salamanders into the streams of eastern Ohio over the summer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
When we come back, we'll hear from the United Nations expert on extreme poverty who visited Appalachia to study regions in the United States that are facing conditions similar to third world countries. We'll also hear why an economic reporter believes our region's longstanding ties to extractive industries is keeping Appalachia poor, sick, and stuck on coal. That's ahead after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Law professor Philip Alston is a United States expert on extreme poverty. He reports on places of pervasive poverty like Haiti, South Asia, Central Africa, and just recently, he was here in Appalachia. Shortly after his 2017 trip here, he spoke with NPR's Kelly McEvers about a report he's compiling on how the United States treats its most vulnerable people.
Philip Alston has spent the past 2 weeks traveling around the United States. First, Washington, D.C., then Los Angeles, San Francisco, Alabama, Puerto Rico, and finally, West Virginia. The United States is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, but Alston wanted to understand how it is that 40 million Americans live in poverty. He is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, and he's with us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What were you looking for on your trip?
I was looking primarily to see the relationship between the civil rights, which the United States holds so dear, and poverty. In other words, if you live in poverty in this country, can you actually enjoy the civil and political rights which you are supposedly guaranteed?
Just give us some examples of things you found in places like here in Los Angeles or in Alabama or in West Virginia.
To go to Skid Row in Los Angeles, to see the extent of it, the never-ending encampments and tents, the really grim circumstances under which people live. To go to Alabama to meet with people who live in areas that have no sewerage connection, and so their sewage is basically just pumped out into their gardens. Those sorts of things have a pretty big impact.
In a presentation for the State Department today, you talked about something that I thought was really interesting. You said that you were struck by the extent to which caricatured narratives about the purported innate differences between the rich and poor have been sold to people by politicians in the media. Just explain that a little bit.
So the rich are industrious, entrepreneurial, patriotic, and the drivers of economic success. The poor, on the other hand, are wasters, losers, and scammers. So as a result, money spent on welfare is money down the drain. Money devoted to the rich is a sound investment. The reality is that the United States now has probably the lowest degree of social mobility among all the rich countries. And if you are born poor, guess where you're going to end up? Poor.
Your findings were not all bad. You talked about some groups that you were in contact with that do some pretty great work. I wonder if you could give us some examples there.
I was very impressed by a lot of the community organizing that's going on in many places. I was very impressed by a voluntary health, dental, even psychological care clinic that I saw called West Virginia Health Right, which has no full-time doctors or dentists, but relies on volunteer services from those communities and ends up seeing 21,000 patients a year.
Do you think that groups like that are a solution to the bigger problem, or they're just one piece of what needs to be more systemic changes?
I have to admit that sometimes I fear that such superb and much-needed initiatives, they are taking the pressure off the state, and the state can sort of sit back and say, oh, well, there's no need in that area. It's being done by these guys.
Hmm. You have been around the world looking at this issue up close. You know, how does the U.S. compare?
Well, I think one of the most striking things is the lack of political will. I don't want to draw a comparison with China, but I did have to say when I was there that what was impressive was that Xi Jinping had made it a priority of his administration to eradicate extreme poverty. And when people said to me, but he's just trying to keep control of the Communist Party, my response was, I think every politician is trying to keep control of government, and if others would dedicate themselves to eliminating poverty, then that would be great.
Philip Alston is the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks. My pleasure.
That story originally aired December 2017 on NPR's All Things Considered. So as we just heard, Appalachia is not the only place in America where some people live in extreme poverty, but several communities here are among the poorest. On Inside Appalachia, we're often looking back at our history and trying to understand, how did this happen? Our problems have been long in the making, and that's the same conclusion our next guest came to after spending nearly a year researching Appalachia's economy. Gwen Guilford is a reporter for the business news site Quartz, and she recently published an article called The 100-Year Capitalist Experiment That Keeps Appalachia Poor, Sick, and Stuck on Coal. Roxy Todd spoke with Guilford about her report.
Let's start a little bit with your story and how you became interested in researching Appalachia's economy.
So basically, in early 2017, I was researching mortality rates and how in certain populations in the U.S. They're rising. And I was trying to figure out, there was a lot of attention on opioid overdoses and how those were influencing the rates of rising death rates. And I was trying to unravel this big puzzle of, you know, what the heck is going on? Why are people dying at higher rates at younger ages and stuff like that? And at some point, I started looking at maps, trying to figure out, because, you know, you look at the U.S. in aggregate, it really doesn't tell you very much. And I started looking at maps and of mortality rates and realized there were a few pockets of areas with worse health outcomes, with, you know, people dying younger and at higher rates. And one of those areas was Central Appalachia. And then I, you know, would look at specific you know, causes of death, and pretty much across the board, Central Appalachia was among the highest places in the U.S. And then, you know, the more I started to look into that, the more I realized the social problems and economic problems, like pretty much any, you know, issue, you name it, whether it's unemployment or welfare reliance and of course, health stuff, there it was, you know, the same area was having way more intense, way more problems than other parts of the U.S. and other parts immediately bordering it.
She says a diverse economy didn't develop in central Appalachia because coal companies chronically underpaid workers. And, well, everyone relied on coal.
Right. So a lot of these themes relate to a problem that is sort of defining issue of our time, which is wealth inequality. Central Appalachia has been struggling with this problem for a really long time, and now it's, you know, becoming a massive problem for all of America. But, you know, for starters, you know, you could look at the middle class. And one of the problems with the structure of Central Appalachia's economy and the way it developed and its reliance on coal is that, you know, it chronically underpaid workers and didn't allow a diverse economy to develop that would have, you know, shifted purchasing power to households. So that basically made it so there was this kind of a middle class never emerged, really. And in the U.S., I mean, speaking more broadly, the creation of the middle class, which again is this like engine of consumption growth that really buoyed America's economic expansion for, like, you know, 30 years after World War II, 30, 40 years. So the middle class was basically created by New Deal reforms that sort of intertwined the interests of capital and labor so that, you know, when labor benefits, the owners of the capital benefit too. And, you know, everybody is better off when the other party is doing well. That relationship has decoupled since, you know, probably the 80s. And now America as a whole is looking increasingly like Central Appalachia in its absence, or, you know, the shrinking of its middle class. And that's a sign that, you know, the economy is not as healthy as it should be. Central Appalachia, you know, there's no way of formally measuring this, but based on its reliance on coal, it hasn't been able to develop a you know, broad, rich, diverse base of industry, and is therefore much more fragile and vulnerable to, like, boom bust cycles and these patterns that, you know, you see happen time and again in central Appalachia over the last 150 years that really, like, hurt communities.
So to oversimplify even more, it's a lot of money being spent to produce one product, coal, extract coal, and the money that comes out of that is not going back to reinvesting in the people or the infrastructure. It's just going to support that industry over and over again.
Right. And that's a really important point you just hit upon. And that, you know, it has a lot to do with the absentee land ownership that, you know, came about for various reasons of colonial development and land speculation. But, you know, most of the land in Central Appalachia was not historically and still is not owned by people who actually live there. And so those people don't have any stake in the communities there. They don't have any reason to reinvest in developing the human capital and, you know, public services and goods in those communities. And that's just a really bad bunch of incentives. Like, their incentive is just to make as much profit as possible for their shareholders who live in New York and Baltimore and London and, you know, now all over the globe.
Well, definitely in this age of, you know, constant parachute journalism, and having been through the last presidential election when the media swarmed in on Appalachia yet again, it's refreshing to talk to someone who's spent a lot of time digging into the context and the history. And I just really appreciate you spending the time looking into this and thinking deeply about issues that are pretty difficult for, I think, the rest of the country to really grapple with. So I appreciate your work and for chatting with me today.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I appreciate, this sounds lame, but your region. I learned so much. It was so fascinating. And I'm, you know, there's stuff like labor history that, you know, this is a pivotal place in terms of our country's labor movement. And we don't learn anything about this. We don't learn anything about, you know, Blair Mountain and Matewan and the absentee land ownership. And it is, as we've discussed, has so much to teach the rest of America that I think is really important. So, yeah, thank you for having me on.
That was economic reporter Gwen Guilford speaking with Roxy Todd. Guilford's article about Appalachia's economy was published earlier this year in Quartz Magazine. You can find a link on our website, wvpublic.org. There you can also hear stories about several of the things Guilford mentioned that are a part of Appalachia's culture, like the mine wars and Matewan, West Virginia's bloody labor history. Guilford also mentioned the issue of absentee land ownership. A report published several years ago found that the top 25 landowners in West Virginia own about a fifth of the state, and most of those landowners live elsewhere. The report was released by the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, and it's the first to take a close look at land ownership since the 1970s. Land ownership has a huge impact on the ability of local people to build their economy, own businesses, grow food, and clean up hazardous waste. Again, you can learn more about these topics on our website, wvpublic.org. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're learning how our reliance on coal and other extractive industries have affected our region's economy. We've also heard several ways these industries have left us with environmental hazards and waste that we'll be struggling to clean up and pay for years to come. We wanted to see how communities out west are coping with these same issues. After all, we're not the only ones grappling with the boom and bust cycles of mining. Kate Schimmel is a Colorado native. She lives in Paonia, Colorado, and works at High Country News as their deputy editor digital. She's also the co-host of a podcast called West Obsessed, which is produced in collaboration with KVNF Community Radio. She's worked with newsrooms in Montana, New Mexico, and Colorado to report on the economic declines rural communities out west are facing. I asked Kate onto our show this week to tell us more about what it means for communities out west to economically depend on one industry, coal. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What did you find? How are mining communities affected by the boom and bust cycles in talking about the challenges?
Yeah, one of the challenges that I've found, actually not in my reporting, but I live in a small town that has a long history of coal mining. And one of the biggest challenges is we've seen now many years of contraction in the coal industry. So we started out with about 8 coal mines. There may even have been more before that, but what I remember is 8, and that shrunk down to 3 when I moved here. And then now we're looking at 1, where a lot of the work is automated, done by machines and not by humans. And so what we've seen at a very basic level is a decline in really high-paying jobs, jobs with a salary of median $80,000 a year. That's sort of, for our community, an incredible salary to be making, and very few local businesses can even come close to matching that. I think our median salary in the county now is somewhere in the range of $35,000. So at a basic level, you lost jobs, and then you lost the spending that those jobs allowed people to do. So you have local businesses that really struggled to sell enough, to serve enough meals. And I think at sort of a different level, we saw the community really struggle to figure out what our future is. Who are we going to be? And that was a tough process that I think we're still in the middle of. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of communities across the West. Some are sort of further along than we are. They've really thought about what they're going to do when coal really finally goes away. And some are further behind. They are still trying to find ways to bring coal back, to reopen coal mines, which is possible in some areas, but in many areas is unlikely to happen due to economic forces, social forces, regulations, a whole variety of things. And where that leaves each community is really different. And I have to say, I don't know that I've seen a single community kind of develop the entire way of responding to that, but the challenges ripple through the entire community, from the economics to the social issues and the culture of the town.
I think a lot of that sounds familiar to many of our Inside Appalachia listeners and is something that we've seen happen here in Appalachia as far as mechanization. You mentioned a lot of the high-paying jobs are being sort of replaced with machines and things like that, and mechanization sort of taking the place of that. What do you think people can do to try to reinvent themselves? How are folks out west moving forward?
What we've seen a lot of in the rural West is turning to more of a recreation or a lifestyle economy. So here in Paonia, what that looks like is we now have a cocktail bar that serves tapas. And some of that's for the community, right? Like community members go there, but that's as much for people passing through or for attracting people from the outside to come live here because Paonia is such a nice place to be. And that is hard for communities. The jobs are not as steady or as high paying as they were when we had coal mines open. And it requires some degree of planning. So it doesn't tend to be as attractive for a town to have sort of an open mine next to where they might want to recreate, right? Where they might want to go running or skiing or biking or wine tasting or whatever it is that that town wants to offer. And so figuring out how to plan for a future that might mean to some extent covering up your past is really hard. I think some of the other choices towns are making or being forced to make is just shrinking, getting smaller. Sort of the depopulation of the rural West is very real and happening relatively quickly.
Yeah, and that's definitely something we're seeing here. Here in Appalachia, recreation tourism is also something that many small towns are trying, and it has brought in some jobs, but maybe not the same type of big salaries, like you mentioned, that are, you know, that people are used to in coal mining. How realistic is it to expect the recreation industry to provide living wages to residents in these rural communities? If these, you mentioned the, you know, taco stand or the, you know, selling tacos in that one restaurant, if that continues to grow and there's more businesses that grow like that, I mean, is that realistic for that kind of community to provide a living wage, you think?
I don't see recreation or lifestyle or service jobs getting up to the same level that coal jobs did in terms of wage. I think there may be some affordability questions, like housing may come down to match that. But the reality is recreation dollars are getting spread around. And more small towns like yours, like mine, are competing for people's sort of disposable income, right? And I talk to an economist about whether that can continue to grow. And his take was, yes. Yes, there is more growth to happen, right? Like people can build out more recreation, more tourism, and attract more people to their town. But at some point, there's a limit. And whether you can turn sort of tourism and recreation, people passing through, right, into permanent residents is not clear. And that's what most towns want. They want people to come through and stay, right? They don't want to keep losing young people, losing people with kids, families. They want people to come and live here. And that's a much harder thing to do. So it might be possible to have more restaurants where people could have server jobs. The question of whether your young people will actually want to do that and will stay here and raise their families is a whole other question.
What kind of expectations do people have for the future? You mentioned that, you know, a lot of people are leaving, and we're certainly seeing that here as people are deciding to move away. I mean, do they see a future in staying? Are people staying and trying to create new things?
Yeah, they are. And it depends on your town, but I think in a lot of towns, you do have somewhat of a stabilization of people moving back to that town and trying to build something. A reporter I worked with did some research and found that more towns than I expected certainly are actually growing or attracting young people or at least holding steady. And they're usually doing that through a few different avenues. One is university or small college, state school or community college is attracting young people. And then some of those people stay after. I think the others are that sort of lifestyle side of things, right? So there's recreation and tourism, getting people to come through your town and spend money there and then leave once they're done. There's also the sort of side effect of that, that town can be a really fun place to live. There are trails or restaurants or whatever that are attractive to young people. And in a few towns in the West, that has actually turned into especially young families coming and staying because it's a good place to raise their kids or to live. They can live relatively cheaply compared to our urban areas and still have a really great quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that they're looking at doing or trying to do to grow their economies?
One of the examples I found most fascinating was Anaconda, Montana, is actually trying, they had a really big mine and manufacturing infrastructure that closed down, and they have these giant heaps of slag, which are the waste, and they're actually trying to use that mining waste to do things like paving or manufacturing. So they're actually trying to sort of stick to their manufacturing and mining past and turn that into a viable economy to provide jobs. That's happening in a few different places. You know, not everywhere is leaving natural resource dependent economy for something else. Sometimes they're trying to turn it into something different, or they're trying to sustain it at a lower level. That's particularly true with logging out here. It's maybe less true with coal mining. But trying to log enough to provide enough jobs to keep enough people in town that town at least doesn't disappear.
Is there anything else that you could share that you found interesting and striking as a native to the region and being able to report on this and seeing your community and people move away and people also stay and invest in their community to try and find a new economy?
Yeah, I'll give you a resident's answer, not a reporter's answer, which is that when people decide to live somewhere, I think it's so important that they decide to take on everything about that place, right? And invest in helping that place be a really good community, a really effective community, whatever that looks like for your town. And I've been so struck by how different that can be from town to town. You know, some towns have these incredible communities where people show up to town meetings, to town council. They run for local positions. They volunteer. And they can build such a strong economy through that, like through that cohesion. And then in other communities where they once made a lot of money, right? Some former coal communities really struggling to figure out what to do next because they don't have that sort of social infrastructure, that community sense that we all need to invest in making sure that this town survives and that it's a place we want to live. I wish there were a better lesson other than the importance of investing in your community. But certainly that's one of the things I've seen as a resident, and I suppose as a reporter too.
Kate, thanks again for giving us some insights into what communities out west are doing to try to move beyond extractive industries. I know that states out west aren't quite as dependent on coal as we are here in West Virginia still, and the coal seams out your way still probably have many years' worth of mining left in them. So it's not an identical situation, but I think it's interesting to learn from communities with a similar situation. And I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fascinating to hear what you guys are working on as well.
You can find more of Kate Schimmel's reporting on economic development in former mining communities in the West at High Country News and with the Solutions Journalism Network. We've posted a longer version of my conversation with Kate Schimmel on our website at wvpublic.org. For our final story, we'll hear about one Appalachian city that has found a way to rebuild itself after it faced economic hardship following the decline of the American steel industry. I'm talking about Pittsburgh, sometimes referred to as the Paris of Appalachia. Not many people there identify as Appalachian, and don't be surprised if they pronounce it Appalachia. But Pittsburgh is, geographically speaking, a part of our region. The state of Pennsylvania has had to step in to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of citizens in more than a dozen financially distressed cities and towns, including Pittsburgh. But last month, the city was deemed financially secure enough to be ready to end its designation as a distressed city. But is the city really able to stand on its own and continue to pay its bills? Or are they in danger of repeating the past? Keystone's Crossroads contributor Margaret J. Krause reports.
People packed the Pittsburgh mayor's conference room on February 12th to witness the city's successful transition to financial independence. City council members, state officials, business people, all chatting happily. Everyone seemed so at ease that River, Pittsburgh's canine ambassador, wandered in. He had time to work most of the front row, to their delight, before someone hauled him out again. Governor Tom Wolf's statement addressed the giddy room.
We've transformed a Rust Belt city. You've done this. It was a symbol of economic decline into one of the most dynamic examples of innovation in the new economy in the world. And this turnaround hasn't been easy.
Pittsburgh Mayor's Chief of Staff Dan Gilman said there's never a perfect time to let go of help, but the city is eager to forge its own path.
It's a strong statement to say the city has come far with the partnership, that we don't need this protection anymore, that we are in strong financial footing, we have a good financial outlook into the future, and it removes that stigma that's been attached to being an Act 47 city.
Act 47 is shorthand for the state's program for financially distressed cities. Think of it as a hospital for cities that are financially unwell. Doctors' orders include restricting costs, such as salaries, and requiring action, such as paying into pension funds. The point is to help governments achieve their central mission, providing services to residents.
Cities have a lot of responsibilities.
That's Brian Jensen of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development.
There are a lot of obligations that they need to make to their residents and businesses to make a city or any municipality a place that you want to live, work, and play.
For a long time, Pittsburgh was not one of those places. Even a quick glance at one of the city's financial recovery plans makes it clear why. In bar graphs, year over year, the debts dwarf the revenues. To add insult to injury, those graphs are laid out in black and yellow. For Pittsburgh and its sports teams, black and gold, or black and yellow, is synonymous with success. The color choice could be a coincidence, but it feels like a jab, an irrefutable picture of falling short, of losing, as though the city itself were a liability, which it was. By the end of 2003, Pittsburgh couldn't support itself, couldn't pay its employees, its debt, couldn't function. So City Council requested Act 47 state oversight. The first step to nurse Pittsburgh back to health was slashing costs. That first year, Pittsburgh fired 400 people, including police, firefighters, and paramedics.
You almost feel robbed.
That's Ralph Sicuro. He's president of Pittsburgh's Firefighters Union.
You know, we felt that there was nothing we could do. Ultimately, we licked our wounds and we moved forward and said, this is what we have to accept.
As the city worked to hold down costs, it closed swimming pools and rec centers. It limited raises and decreased benefits. Sicuro says city employees are partners to Pittsburgh's economic recovery. They took it on the chin so the city could get on its feet. Sicuro says they were glad to, eventually, but in their contract negotiation this year, firefighters will be looking to make up lost ground.
If they don't see a willingness to provide adequate wage growth in the next contract, they're going to be extremely disappointed in this administration. People who don't feel appreciated by their employer are not happy at work. And when you don't have happy employees at work, it's not good for anybody.
Under state oversight, municipalities can tell public sector unions they simply can't afford to give them what they want. Now, for Pittsburgh, that protection is gone. City officials say they'll respect their employees while protecting taxpayers. But legacy costs, such as pensions, remain an ongoing challenge. Here's Jensen again from the Allegheny Conference.
Pittsburgh's pension plans were severely underfunded, and it was a big problem because over many, many years, they had not put in enough money into the retirement plan, and they got into a real deficit situation on the retirement plans.
Here's why pensions are such a big deal. They're not optional. A city must pay retirees. And if a city can't make pension payments, Jensen says that money has to come from somewhere else.
That is to say, the taxpayer, you and me, that has to make up that difference.
Jensen says Pittsburgh has made tremendous progress in dedicating more money to its pensions and paying off its debt. As long as they remain financially prudent, Jensen says the future looks bright. But former oversight advisor to the city, Michael Danovitz, isn't so sure.
Well, I'm concerned about the pension. The pension, at least I consider, is significantly underfunded. This is not atypical of a city our size, but we can do better. If we have a downturn in the market, we could see all those gains over the last 4 or 5 years evaporate.
Which would put Pittsburgh right back where it started, when it had no money, couldn't provide for its citizens, and lost population. So leaving state oversight is a risk, but so is staying in. It's a pickle Matt Pacifico knows well. He's the mayor of Altoona, Pennsylvania. The city is 100 miles east of Pittsburgh and 6 months ahead. Altoona left Act 47 in September of 2017. Pacifico's central campaign promise was getting out of state oversight.
There's really zero flexibility to govern the city the way that you want to govern it, you know, when you're under Act 47 control.
Pacifico describes it as a black cloud, which is why it was so important to get out.
It shows potential businesses who might be looking to move into the state that things are really turning around for the city, so I might want to move my business or my company there.
Local flower shop owner Chelsea Kerr is among a handful of entrepreneurs who in the last year have taken a chance on downtown Altoona and moved their businesses there.
And the more willing you are to do something in a town that doesn't have much, then other people see that. And I thought that it could be successful and it would bring more businesses to the area.
Kerr's business has doubled since August. It's a nod to Altoona's cash flow, but points to another piece of financial recovery, says the Allegheny Conference's Brian Jensen. Let's call it a positive feedback loop.
The more a municipality can show that it's doing the right thing, that it's being responsible with the taxpayers' money, making the kind of investments that are needed, the more secure residents and businesses feel about investing back in their communities.
Both Altoona and Pittsburgh officials say they know that's a fragile trust, and they're wary of backsliding. But all they can do is keep costs down and pension funding high. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
It's hopeful to hear a Rust Belt City success story in Pittsburgh. It took a lot of work, and it sounds like that work's not done yet. But that's the way it is here in Appalachia. We got a lot of work to do, and that's part of the legacy of coal. On today's show, we heard about the cleanup effort in one town damaged from mining activity, an effort funded by the federal government. But we also learned about how radioactive waste from fracking is a real problem, and perhaps the federal government isn't monitoring it as closely as it should. Are we destined to make the same mistakes with the natural gas industry that we did with coal? Coal did put food on the tables of many families, but did it also create the foundation for extreme poverty? And yet, we're resistant here in coal country, and we know how to lean on each other. That's one part of the legacy that I hope never goes away. And surprisingly, it connects us with others. Out in Colorado, coal country native Kate Schimmel reminds us that we're not alone. She believes the best way to revive and support your community is to get involved where you live. And that makes sense. Perhaps if more of the people who owned land in West Virginia actually lived in West Virginia, our legacy would look a little different. But here we are, and it's from here that we move forward. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Ohio Valley Resource, NPR's All Things Considered, Keystone Crossroads, State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, KVNF in Paonia, Colorado, High Country News, and the Solutions Journalism Network. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Ibi Caputo edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.